guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and it's time we run the tech vet. As usual, for almost every Sunday night for the last 32 years, this will be TechNet number 1552 of the series that began way back in September of 1982. TechNet is a gathering of the guys in the New York City tri-state area primarily, who gather to help each other try to understand this fairly complicated hobby of ham radio and how wireless equipment works, how to make it work better by way of IRLP and Echo Link. Eric KE2EJ, the major technical guy associated with Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, has hooked up those methods by which out-of-state people or out-of-town people far away in other states, countries, and whatever can also check into the technical net. In order for them to be able to check in, we've got to leave enough space after the four beeps so that the machine can properly reset. And there is a slight protection if we override that. Let me drop it. And that is John. Let me wait for the four beeps. John, KC2WGB, our co-net control person, who also handles the mailbag. He monitors the Echo Link website. So therefore, if you have trouble checking in because you didn't leave enough space by way of Echo Link, he will know about it, and you can even give him messages as to the fact that you've got some further information to gather, pass on to us. As individual subjects come up, people listening to the TechNet say, hey, I know something about that. I mean, people think that the people running the TechNet are trying to be experts in everything. And let's face it, all engineers, all people who try to give out information have a certain batting average. And nobody bats 1,000. You occasionally make errors. And so when errors occur, or when people have some further knowledge on a subject, they chime in and let us know about it. And that's how this net works. That's how this gathering works. Let me drop. Over the 32 years of the technical net, we've slowly evolved a kind of a menu that we don't stick to real solidly, but still it does help make the whole system work smoothly. That is, during approximately the first hour, we take call-in questions for people who have questions or comments that they want to pass on to the group or they want to ask the group. At the end of the first hour, John KC2WGB opens the mailbag, in which he selects throughout the week a subject, two or three, which we feel is of general interest. And sometimes guys who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, they make their thoughts and questions known by that manner. So John chooses a few of those, and we go through them. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who will tell us what International Space National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And I think he's about to give us Space Net Report number 144. That's a good number. Is it 144? Oh, it might be 145. How about that? 145 is what I think it is. And then after that, we do whatever, if you know what I mean. Try to talk about subjects that are more general than the ones that during the first hour. But there is a limit to that. By that I mean, still the subject has to have some form of interest to the majority of ham radio operators. Let me drop. Now, ham radio operators are sort of scientists, and they're interested in many things, but there's a limit. In fact, nowadays, very few people with self-respect, so to speak, or who have knowledge that's been gathered over the last few decades, very few people are going to be interested in the subject of perpetual motion or above-unity machines. There's reason to believe that above-unity machines do not really work. They're a bit of a hoax, and then perpetual motion machines do not really work. There's probably 98% of the population believes that. Those who are technically informed. So subjects like that may be not appropriate, if you know what I mean, unless an extremely brief discussion about how crazy some of these opinions are and Aikens is coming, if you know what I mean. A person signs into the technical net because it does question or comment, giving John, Paul, Dick, and also Al, K6TPZ. You give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in might be N2APG, Dave, and yes. So, if you've got a question or a comment, give us your call letters and name right now. K2LAW.
It's Roy White. Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Joe. One of our frequent sign-ins. Anyone else?
Kudos to Eric. 375 is sounding great.
Yeah, that probably was Vito, W2PJF. And Eric has been doing some yeoman work on the Eastern machine. In other words, on 146 megacycles, this group, Long Island Mobile Amateur Club, Amateur Radio Club, has a repeater in Glen Oaks, which is right on the Nassau-Suffolk border of Long Island. And they've also got a machine out in Selden on 147.375. And the link, the radio link between the two, which used to be a computer link, gave us a lot of grief. And so, with a whole lot of man hours of work, Eric, KE2EJ. Eric, the main person with the technical smarts with this group, has done a lot of work on that radio link, and now it not only is a lot more reliable, but it's got some real good sound to it, the right level of audio. In fact, let me check on that right now. Yeah, the right level of audio and a reasonably high fidelity audio. So I'm pretty sure that's what Vito was referring to. All right, when it comes to check-ins, Vito, are you checking in? Because quite often you've got a question. And anyone else to check in, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
WS2N.
And that is Paul, WS2N, who will be giving us the space report, which I think is number 145 tonight. Anyone else to check in, give me your call letters and name right now. And the person doing that malicious jamming, if you hear on the input when you go to your input of your machine, in other words, go to the input frequency, depending on what you hear, please report it to LIMOC at LIMOC interference, or even also, there's various ways you can report it to LIMOC what you hear. The person probably also doesn't know that there's a system in place which can help place where that is coming from. That person probably doesn't know that. Anyone else to check in besides Joe? Give me your call letters right now. K2RAW.
2BHY, yes.
KB2CGL, yes.
Okay. The first one I heard was blank 2BHY. What is the rest of your prefix, sir? And tell me your name. Please repeat that. Okay, we know it's K-2-B-H-Y. What's the real prefix and your name, sir?
Prefix is Kilo Delta. Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Hotel Yankee, Jim, yes.
Very fine, Jim. We got it all that time. KB-2, Charlie Golf Lemur, I think it is. Please tell me your name.
Kilo Delta 2, Canada, Golf Lima, Robert.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2, we got that right. Robert, very fine. All right, so we've got Joe, Jim, and Robert checked in so far. Anyone else that wants to check in because they do have a question or a comment, please give me a call with us and name right now. Okay, there being none, we probably have more than enough to get started. Hey, Joe. Trying to remember what subject we discussed with you last time. Oh, yes, measuring capacitors and inductors. And a darn good subject because an amazing number of amateur radio operators and even engineers don't realize you don't need a RCEL meter in order to measure capacitors, for instance. There are much simpler ways that if you got a digital voltmeter and the source of 60 cycle power, you can measure capacitors. Probably all the way down to a picofarad. So go right ahead, Joe. W2RYY, K2RAW.
Good evening, Vic. W2RYY. My question for this episode of TechNet is
It's I'd like to be able to check a Ballon, a 1-to-1 Ballon that has an SO239 termination one end, and eyelets at the other side of the Ballon. I'll tell you what I did afterwards, but I'd like to get a consensus from you and then about how you think you check it to find out if the Ballon works correctly. It's supposed to be rated from 80 meters to 10 meters. Back to you.
Yeah, first I guess we got to start off with sort of defining what a Ballon is, because not everyone is familiar with them. Very handy device. Logically, a person feeding a piece of coaxial cable to, say, a dipole antenna, you're not doing terrible things if you simply put the center conductor to the right side of the dipole and the shield of the cable to the left side of the dipole. It works. However, the way the dipole behaves, it wants to see a balanced signal. It wants to see as much positive on the right side as negative on the left side during its operation, during the first half cycle, so to speak. You end up with some RF energy flowing back down the outside of the coax. That's not a showstopper, but it really means the length of your coax in the outer that outer shield length now becomes part of the resonant length of the antenna. And so it makes tuning the antenna more difficult. Sometimes the radiating shield will give you some grief if it goes by sensitive equipment. Like if that cable is run up the side of an apartment building, you're going to be sending a strong signal to the people at adjacent floors, if you know what I mean. So using a Ballon forces a balancing structure. In other words, it forces a balancing signal. Your unbalanced signal coming out of your coax cable, in other words, all the signal is on the center conductor compared to the outer shield. The Ballon at the end that you put to a dipole will force equal positive and negative voltage on those two eyelids, so to speak, that go to the dipole itself. Let me drop.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead with your comment.
Okay, I just wanted to say, Dick, that did he mention about how you could check a Ballon if you buy one if you're not sure if it's a 4-to-1 or a 1-to-1, a simple way?
That's not his question. My understanding of his question is that he wants to assure that even if it's a 1-to-1, that it's got the proper impedance Ballon and the proper voltage Ballon is what I believe Joe is asking. Let's see if I got that correctly. W2RYY, give us those extra words of your question, Joe. K2RYW.
Essentially correct. I'd like to verify that the Ballon is operating correctly before I attempt to assembly my low-band HF antenna experiment and, go forward that way. I'd rather know that I have a good Ballon than an unknown and, be going way out in the left field. You know what I mean?
Dick, can I answer the question real fast with some quickie answers?
I'll give it a try, Joe. Hal.
Simple thing to do. You get a Ballon, you don't have to 4-to-1, a 1-to-1, a 2-to-1. Very simple. What you do, you take your antenna analyzer, set it around 14 megahertz, take a pot of 500 ohms, and bring the pot in until you have a 1-to-1 reading. When you have a 1-to-1 reading on your antenna analyzer, measure the resistance of the pot. That will tell you the output impedance of the Ballon. And then if you know the output impedance of the Ballon and the input impedance, you know what ratio the Ballon is. That's my quickie. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a darn good suggestion, Hal, for somebody who owns an antenna analyzer. And if you don't own an antenna analyzer, you can use any other kind of standing wave ratio indicator. When the Ballon presents the right impedance to the end of your cable, because you put the right number of ohms of that potentiometer at the output end, that means all the signal flows down the cable once, none of it comes back. And so measuring standing wave ratio by way of a standing wave ratio bridge or a standing wave ratio indicator and adjusting the pot to the lowest standing wave ratio is another way of doing it without the antenna analyzer. The good news about the antenna analyzer, it runs at very low power and you're not going to be overpowering the potentiometer. The bad news about most of the standing wave ratio indicators we own, and I could even use include a bird watt meter, where you measure forward to reverse ratio, and you look at reverse power, and you tune the potentiometer for minimum reverse power, and that would be the impedance match you're looking for. The trouble with all of those is that to get above the power where your standing wave indicator will read correctly, or your bird watt meter, your bird watt meter, your directional power meter. meter will read correctly, probably requires a number of watts of power that's beyond what your potentiometer can tolerate. So that represents a little bit of a problem. But as you can see by, let me drop.
That's why I said you can't do a power measurement deck with a carbon pot. But an analyzer or an impedance bridge, you can get away with it.
Good point, Hal. We're indicating the theory of operation of measuring the balance, impedance, which is one of the things that Joe is asking for. And so, in theory, you can do it with higher power, and maybe you can do it by very brief transmissions. In other words, your power meter, your directional power meter, your visual bridge, maybe it wants 10 watts to give you a reading, and you think your potentiometer can barely tolerate 1 watt. Or if you're transmitting dots with a low enough duty factor, and looking at the indication, there's ways you can get around that, if you know what I mean. And you want to test it also. In Joe's case, he'd like to make the test that each of the bands of his fan dipole, Joe's in the process of building a fan dipole, probably 80 through 10 meters. And so to test at each one of those frequencies would be another way of checking the quality of the balance. And by conservation of energy, if the potentiometer is set at the right number of ohms, like 50 ohms if it's a 1-to-1, or 100 ohms if it's a 2-to-1 balance, and so on, he'll know by the least amount of reflected power coming back toward the transmitter by way of any of those instruments we just mentioned. He'll know when he's found the right impedance. Let me drop. Unfortunately, that's two-thirds of what Joe is looking for. The other third really is how well balanced is the balance. If the balance was perfectly correct, and if, for instance, 100 volts is coming out of the balance right now, you'd like the right side to be plus 50 and the left side to be minus 50 on the first half cycle, and vice versa. And if the right side was plus 75 and the left side was minus 25, still 100 volt difference, that would only be a partial balance operation. And to confirm that second characteristic of a balance is a bit more difficult. But let's see if what Joe has heard so far is in the right direction of what he's looking for, and to check that balancing ratio is a considerably more difficult test, but it can be done. To B2RYY for further information and comments. K2RYW and TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, I wasn't trying to check the balance on each side. I was essentially trying to do a very simplistic test to find the balance just simply works correctly. And what I did was I took a piece of coax and hooked that to the output side of the balance. And terminated the output at the other end of the coax, using RG2PAU, with a 50 ohm dummy load of good return loss quality, like about minus 25, minus 30. So I knew it was good, and so was my loin. As I checked the balance starting at 14 megahertz, using the transceiver I was using, I could take the transceiver's power up to about easily up to 50 watts, and I read no reflective power from the input side of the balance. As I went up to 21 meg, it started to go up a little bit, went up more at 24 meg, like 1.5 to 1, and it's about 2 to 1 at the time I got to 28 meg. And I went down the other way, and went down to like 7 meg, 3.5 meg, and actually a little below 3 meg. And I also noticed the same thing, as it started going like above and below an approximate beam width, what I was suspecting between 3 or 4 meg and about 21, 22 meg, I would watch the reflective power on my transceiver start to go up. And I took the coax off the balance and put the coax into the back of the transceiver just to verify it wasn't my coax, and the coax gave me a flat SWR for the dummy load. So it wasn't part of the problem that I was seeing. I took another balance that came from another source, and it tested it and gave me very similar results. The balance I was using, I was previously using outdoors on my single 80-meter antenna, some years ago, but since it was outside, I was wondering if water or something got in it, but apparently not, because two balance, one that I had used before, was giving me similar results, but the result is a normal type frequency where you start seeing a bandwidth, sort of relative bandwidth that goes, starts going above a certain VSWR as you go below a frequency and above a frequency. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this is a good set of questions, Joe, and you fell into a trap. You used good common sense. good common sense is that a balun that has a coax input rated for 50 ohms, and if it's a 1-to-1 balun, the two output connectors will also be at 50 ohms. And you put a supposedly good 50 ohm load, which is a length of coax of some length, going into a good dummy load. You put a 50 ohm load on there. And by way of various testing procedures, you could measure the quality of that output coax and 50 ohm load. But now you fell into a trap. Bear in mind now that the whole reason we use a balun on, say, a dipole-like antenna is because Mother Nature has dictated that a dipole is a thoroughly symmetric antenna. In other words, when it's being fed correctly, it wants positive voltage on the right side, negative of the same magnitude on the left side of the dipole during the first half cycle, for instance. And it will force that condition. Therefore, it forces RF energy to flow down the outside of the coax. By you using coax as a load, assuming the balun was perfect, the balun has two output rivets, so to speak, or two output, let's call them loops to it. And the right-hand loop is, at one instant of time, plus 10 volts, and the left-hand loop is minus 10 volts. And you put that balanced signal with reference to ground on a piece of coax cable, that minus 10 volts on the left side going to the shield of your cable is forcing the shield to be a radiator. Now the length of that coax going into the 50 ohm dummy load is itself an antenna. The signal is flowing on the outside of the coax cable that you used as a load. Now as you go to various frequencies, the length of that coax going into the dummy load is going into and out of quarter wave, half wave resonances and making things complicated. What you needed, Joe, was a thoroughly balanced
repeater. Timeout.
What you needed was a thoroughly balanced load. And even with coax cable, you can come close to simulating that. If instead of one piece of output coax cable, you had two pieces of output coax cable. In other words, two pieces of cable side by side, shields connected together, and one center conductor goes to one output connector of the balun, the other center conductor of the other cable goes to the other output connector on the balun. You've now got a balanced load. Unfortunately, two pieces of coax cable side by side used that way with two separate dummy loads would be a 100 ohm load, not a 50 ohm load. And now how could we force that? By way of a T connector at the far end? Yes. I think if we put a T connector at the far end and then put the dummy load on the T connector and the two pieces of cable go into the T connector. I gotta think about that one. But as you can see, what you did with your one piece of coax is very similar to what happens when you take an ordinary piece of coax straight to a dipole. The dipole tries to force a balance right side versus left side. So your length of your cable, out of curiosity, Joe, what was the length of the cable that went to your 50 ohm dummy load? As you're now finding out, it was part of the radiating resonant length of your testing system. Therefore, it made your testing much more complicated. W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
UY2U with some comments when you get a chance to take over.
Approximately 10 to 12 feet long. It wasn't a very long piece of cable. It was just a spare piece of cable I have that happened to have an end connector on one side for terminating into the dummy load. Back to you.
Now, Professor Mike, WY2U, who teaches subjects like this in his particular college, bet you've met this problem before, Mike, and it's a tough one. Let's see how you've solved it. WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet. Glad to hear from you. You got to check in a little more often, Mike.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening to all. Yes, I do have some comments, but if I could, I have to ask Joe two questions, first of all. Or I can ask you if you know the answer. Does he have access to either a QRP radio or an antenna analyzer, first of all?
You've got it, Joe.
I own a service monitor with an antenna bridge that is rated from 1 meg to 1,000 meg, so the answer to that is yes.
Got it, Mike.
Okay, that's very good news. Well, first of all, he wants to check, I gather, the balance or how good of a quality the balance is between the two output nodes of, let's say, 1-to-1 balun, which is designed for 50 ohms. It is going to be connected to a dipole-like antenna, I'm ascertaining. So what he's interested in, Dick, is more, not necessarily voltage balancing, but he wants to feed equal currents into both sides of the antenna, so he's interested in current balancing. A technique that we developed at MPD to check that exact kind of an issue would be to put two dissimilar value resistors on the output of the balance so that they total up to about 50 ohms. Now, what you need to know is how much imbalance you could expect to see in a dipole. When we did extensive work in this, we ended up with two values like 39 ohms for one resistor and 10 ohms for another resistor. Carbon composition would be fine. Keep the lead short. They total up to about 49 ohms total. Let me drop.
And I'm going to guess that the center tap of those two resistors is going to the grounding system on the input of the balance. That's a guess on my part. You've got it, Mike. Wait for the four beams, please.
Yes and no, because actually what I want to do is I want to check all three nodes. Node 1 will be the junction of the balun and the 36 ohm. Node 2 will be the junction of the 36 ohm and the 14 ohm. And node 3 would be the junction of the 14 ohm alone and the other side of the balun. A short clip lead. Which is going to be connected to ground. The first thing you want to do is measure the static VSWR just with that load arrangement connected to the balun. I'm assuming it's going to be better than a 1.5 to 1, and I'll make the assumption that it is. So what you're going to do now is one at a time, you're going to ground all three nodes. If you really have a balun and the thing is isolated well, no matter what you do to the output, the VSWR shouldn't change. I'll allow it to go to 2 to 1, which probably would equate to something like about a half a dB imbalance in current on two legs of a dipole, which will probably be more than tolerant to give you a very unnoticeable amount of scalloping. So what you want to do is one at a time short each one of those nodes to ground and note what the change of VSWR is. Ideally, it should not change at all. Right, Dick?
And now I've got a question for you, Mike, and that is, if I bring the clip lead to each one of those three junctions of those two resistors in series that are connected in series as the output of the balun, and I bring my clip lead grounding to lead number one, number two, number three, and this is the best of all baluns, yes, the VSWR should stay the same. That's a thoroughly floating current source balun, and is a kind of a balun that would work. In other words, if this was a voltage balun by the Grinnella definition, where it issues equal voltage right side and left side, not as ideal, but if you've got a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a well-installed dipole where there isn't a great big tree shielding half the dipole on one side, or one side of the dipole is not coming close to your gutters of your house, your rain collecting system, then that would work. Your test is testing the idealness of a current source, thoroughly floating output kind of balun. I agree with that. That's a good test. Has this been written up anywhere, Mike? WY2U, K2LAW in the TechNet?
Gosh, I want to say yes, but probably going back about 30 years where we had a whole bunch of lab shop notes that we passed along between the engineers, because we run into these kinds of funnies from time to time. And there was a whole compendium of these things, and I'll be darned, I'll have to look around and see if I have it anywhere. Yeah, it's internal shop notes. They are available, but I'll certainly have to look around for them. Over.
So somewhere in the archives of the MPD company, which made a whole lot of high power equipment and had to have balance. So I wonder if it's a little bit more clear, Joe, as to why a coaxial cable of some length going to a real good dummy load on the output of a one-to-one balun is not a good load, because half of the voltage coming out of the balun, you could say, is going to the shield of the cable, which is then radiating it. Now, the physical length of that coaxial cable becomes a quarter wavelength, a half wavelength, three-eighths wavelength at certain frequencies. And so the impedance of that radiation and the variation versus frequency is what's aggravating the test that you did. And so, as you can see, you've done some good logical testing, but you fell into a trap as to what the balun is trying to do. And if coax as a dummy load and what you used would have given a good test, then feeding the coax cable directly to the dipole in the first place, when everybody does it that way, wouldn't have given us any grief. And so you're sort of backstepping to that condition, Joe. Let's see if it's made a little bit more sense. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. Good question.
Not completely, because I'm trying to understand why you use different values of resistors on the output of this ballon. I thought it was supposed to be an even amount of current going to both legs, the right half and the left half of your dipole, theoretically, if you had a dipole. And that presents a certain exact impedance at a resonant frequency. And I'm trying to basically duplicate that across the band of frequencies to verify that the device under test was working correctly. So why again do I use different value resistors?
I'm going to plug in some words from Mike on this one. Let me drop. Then I'm going to turn it over to Mike to correct me. If the ballon is the best of all ballons, it's going to act a little bit like the secondary winding of a transformer. The secondary winding of a transformer is thoroughly floating compared to the primary. The primary may be going to a LIPA or a PSENG power, and one side of that is grounded. But the thoroughly floating secondary only cares about differential resistance, so to speak. You put the right resistor across that secondary winding, and the transformer behaves the way it's supposed to. And you could make that secondary resistor, it's supposed to be 100 ohms, we'll say, and yes, you could use 50 ohms from each side to ground, or you could use 10 ohms and 90 ohms each side to ground, and the floating characteristic of that secondary winding of this transformer, in my example, would accommodate that. You'd never know the difference. The most ideal ballon in the world is looking for the right differential impedance, but other than that, with reference to ground, the thing thoroughly floats. And that's what Mike is testing. By two unequal resistors, he's making the right differential resistance, but the individual resistances to ground, he's intentionally make it wrong to find out, is it acting like a secondary winding of a transformer? Is the output apparently truly floating, so that you're issuing equal current to the right side, equal current to the left side, irrespective of where the ground really is? Is that approximately what you were saying, Mike? WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, sir, WY2U. That's exactly correct, Dick. And the reason for those two particular resistor values was, now you're making me wish I could find the shop notes, because those two particular resistor values, when you measured the differential change in VSWR between all three nodes, there was a whole set of equations worked out that we had, I'll be darned if I can remember them now, that would tell you how good or how poorly in dB the isolation of the ballon was. So there was a little work that was done in research to come up with those values, but it actually gave some credence as to how good the balance was when you finally did the measurements. Go ahead.
Among the so-called simple passive devices that we as electronic engineers, radio engineers use, the word ballon is one of the ones that's highly misunderstood. A man named Ruff, back in the 1980s, wrote an article in Microwave Theory and Techniques, the magazine, in which the article was entitled Some Balloning Devices. A very simple sounding title, and you think he's going to talk about one or two things. Well, he had something like 18 separate classes of ballons in that article. You go to the Antenna Engineering Handbook, the reference, yeah, Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you go to one of the later chapters on the subject of ballons, you'll see there's approximately 18 different kinds of ballons, and some of them have got people's names to them, like the Marchand and the Gorilla and so on. So the word ballon is a very wide subject with many applications of the so-called floating characteristic of a secondary winding of a transformer. That's one of the main characteristics the ballon is trying to do. And in some cases, let me drop this. In some cases, not only is it giving you this balancing characteristic of equal current, left side, right side, proper operation, if you've got the right differential resistance, irrespective of improper resistance, right side to ground versus left side to ground, which it's supposed to be able to tolerate. So not only is it supposed to do that function, that floating output function with reference to ground, but simultaneously provide the right impedance match, so you can have balance that do the balancing function
the right current, left and right side. At the same time, they've got a 1-to-1 ratio, a 4-to-1 ratio, a 10-to-1 ratio, whatever. So you can combine characteristics, but the balancing function is the one that you're coming up against right now, Joe, and your particular test had this extra characteristic. Your outside of your coax cable was hot, therefore its length became part of a tuned circuit. You would think that you take that coax cable to your good dummy load, connect it to your transmitter, to your standing wave ratio meter, whatever. It's perfect. It's a perfect 50 ohm load. But that test alone doesn't test its floating characteristic and its non-radiating characteristic. It's that radiation of the outside of the coax cable that you incited, that you excited, that created the grief of your measurements. And so you're two-thirds of the way down the road of confirming that balance there, Joe. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the tech man.
One more comment, Dick, W-I-2-U.
You've got it, Mike. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, yeah, Joe, in addition to what Dick is saying, I just wanted to offer maybe one more piece of advice as to what the measurements, if you wanted to try my measurements, what they might lead. On the low end of the band, I gather your balance going down to 3 megahertz or something like that for the 80-meter band, perhaps 160. Insufficient inductive reactance in the transformer, especially in the roughest design to ground, will give rise to an increase in VSWR because you no longer have an ideal transformer. You now have a load, let's assume it's 50 ohms, in parallel with whatever the residual inductive reactance of the balanced transformer is. And that's the reason why the low end would have relatively poor performance. Now, it turns out the exact opposite happens on the high end because, again, you don't have an ideal transformer. In addition to the magnetic coupling between primary and secondary, you're going to have a certain amount of leakage capacitance on each turn coupling to the secondary via capacitive leakage. And instead of having totally magnetic coupling, now all of a sudden you've got capacitive and magnetic coupling, and that's going to give rise to a deterioration on the high end. So the balun is only going to be useful between the frequency ranges F1 and F2, where the inductance reactance is much, much greater than 50 ohms on the low end, and the capacitive reactance leakage is much, much greater than 50 ohms on the high end. I hope that helps a little bit, Joe. Back to net, W-I-2-U.
Now, we are getting a little bit into the finer points of feeding an ideal balanced antenna system. As your balun does, every balun at some frequency, if you designed a unidello-like balun for the 80-meter band and above 80 to 10 meters, and you use it at 160 where it wasn't designed, it's going to have some imbalance characteristic to it, similar to what Mike was telling us. And you feed an 160-meter dipole that way, it's not going to catch on fire. All hell's not going to break loose. Just that your coax cable going to that balun, going to that antenna, is going to be a little bit hot. And so knowing that ahead of time allows you to prepare for it. You might have a little bit of RF in the shack. So this is not a showstopper if you fail it. But when you're getting to the specifics of making the measurement, it's going to tell you where you stand, Joe, to be to RYY. And by the way, the first time a person hears this jazz, it's going to sound like, what in the world's going on here? You got to hear all this jazz about balance a couple of times in a row before it starts making some sense. So if you're saying, I don't quite understand all this, Joe, you're in good company. To be to RYY, K2RI to be in the tech net.
Okay, as we're progressing along here in this discussion, let me ask you this. What would happen in simplicity if I simply put a 50-ohm resistive load across the outlet islets of the balun? Not the ground, but simply across the islands. What would that give me as far as a reading?
Okay, assuming you're putting the right amount of power in there, you're not burning up that resistor, and assuming you measured very close to a 1-to-1 VISWA, that would be a necessary but not sufficient. You would confirm that your balun is a 1-to-1 impedance matching device. That's the good news. The bad news is that this floating secondary winding of a transformer characteristic, that in itself would not be confirmed by that test. I could put a 50-ohm resistor across the end of a coax cable. That coax cable, in other words, I've got my coax cable going into a black box. And I'm telling you, inside that black box, there really is a balun, or there really is nothing but a piece of straight feed through coax cable. So that you don't know the difference. And on the two output leads of that black box, you put your 50 ohm resistor. You're going to measure perfect results, whether there's a real balun in there or not a real balun, just a piece of coax cable. So it doesn't confirm that floating characteristic, if you know what I mean. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW.
So I need to use different resistances on each leg, but the total has to be 50 ohms to ground on each side or 100 ohms to ground on each side?
None of the above. All you have to have for the test that Mike was telling us about is that the differential resistance, the resistance from left lug to right lug, will total to 100 ohms. Not correction, total to 50 ohms. However, by intentionally making the left resistor and the right resistor that are in series, although they total 50 ohms, by intentionally making them not 25 ohms each, in this case 39 ohms and 10 ohms, by intentionally making a resistive imbalance to ground, but proper differential resistance total, you're now testing the first and second characteristic of the balun by now moving that clip lead to the three separate nodes. If the balun was perfect, if it's really acting like the secondary winding of a transformer, then moving the clip lead will have no effect. You measure one-to-one standing wave ratio at all possible frequencies if it's perfect. Depending on how much VisWire you measure, left node, center node, and right node of those three resistors, depending on what differential standing wave ratio you measure, and you go to the right equations that probably in this tech node of Mike's, you now know something about what's going on inside your balun and what degree of imperfection it has. So he intentionally chose different resistors that totaled 50 ohms. The B2LYY, I know this is crazy sounding, K2LIW in the TechNet.
But it's the TechNet, so it should sound crazy for the first time, or so in front of this stuff. Okay, what if I use three resistors totaling up, say, 50 ohms, precision resistor assembly where, the three of the total 50 ohms, would it have to have a different? One is 39, one is 10, one is, something else that equals 50 ohms, or can I use three resistors where I'm going to be tapping on the, between one side, one leg, or another leg of the resistors and go into ground and see if it changes the VSWR appreciably? Can I do something like that?
If you wanted to make the problem a little bit more complicated than it has to be, you could use three resistors of 10, 10, and 30. You've now got the you could use a 9, 11, and 30, if you know what I mean. Three slightly different resistors, and now you've got four nodes to put your clip lead on. That doesn't give you additional information. You can do it that way if you want to. It doesn't give you additional information. The elegance of simplicity of Mike's testing procedure by two unequal resistors that total 50 ohms, but they're not the same resistor, left side and right side. By moving that clip lead to those three points, it gives you all the data you want. In your case, you're going to have four places to put the clip lead, and I don't think you're getting any additional information out of that technique. Now, use that technique if that's the only way you've got enough power of resistors, power dissipation capability that totals 50 ohms, but yet one of your nodes, left side, right side, and one of the nodes in the middle are not a pure 25 ohms each side, so to speak, you will be making Mike's like of measurement. Do it that way if you want to, but you're adding a little bit more complication, and it doesn't give you additional information. That's my belief on this one. Let me pass it over to Mike for confirmation. WYTU. Professor Mike, you got it, K2LIW.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what adding that third variable into this mess is going to give you at all. Unless, of course, that's the only way he can get three resistors to total up to 50 ohms. I'm thinking maybe three 18-ohm resistors. That'll give you, 54 ohms? If you have three 18-ohm resistors, that would be fine. It's just that you don't have to measure across each 18-ohm resistor individually. You could just sum up two of them and make the first set of resistors 36 ohms. And then you can do the measurement on 36 ohms and 18 ohms. You're going to get a slightly different set of equations, to figure out what the imbalance in your balun would be. But sure, that should work. But again, I agree with you. I don't see any need for complicating the issue. Two resistors give you all the information that you need. Back to net, WI to you.
Very fine, Mike, and thanks for checking in. Yeah, the most severe portion of this test, as I see it, Joe, is that even if you put a pure 50-ohm resistor, just one resistor, across the output of your balun, and now with that clip lead, you first do the test with nothing but the 50-ohm resistor, and you measure one-to-one visor, hopefully at almost all of your frequencies. Then when you put a clip lead from either side of that 50-ohm resistor to ground, you've now forced a huge imbalance. If the balun is good enough, you'll measure no change in standing wave ratio when the clip lead is on the right side to ground or left side to ground. You have now confirmed that the secondary winding of this transformer, mental model of this thing, that the secondary winding is thoroughly floating. So a single 50-ohm resistor, RCO7, a carbon composition 50-ohm resistor, hang on the inside, outside of the balun, confirmed 50 ohms with your Vislar characteristic of your service monitor, and then ground right side, and then ground left side with a very short clip lead to the coax cable going into the balun. If the balun is really doing its job, that will show you almost no change. I'll admit you're not going to have as much quantitative data as Mike's two-resistor test, but that is a beautiful go-no-go to prove that the secondary winding, so to speak, is thoroughly floating. That's a guess on my part. Let's see if Mike goes along with this one. WI2U. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Can you copy me over there, Dick?
You sound beautiful. Please proceed, Mike.
Okay. Yeah, I concur, Dick. Again, I think we started that way back when we started to take a look at characteristics of balance. But in every balun we've ever done, there was a change in VSWR. We never knew how bad or how good the balun was. So your test is rather extreme. You know, you're assuming that if this was going to be connected to a dipole antenna, one side of the antenna is not contributing anything to radiation. It's like a short. So that's extreme. But that is a very good go-no-go test. If you can pass that, and let's say the VSWR maintains itself, I'm going to throw a number out. I'm not sure if it's right, but if you can get less than a 3-to-1 VSWR doing it that way, you probably have a good balun device. Over.
I thank you, Mike. So I wonder if that makes a little more sense, Joe. And maybe you're going to have to go to amateurradio.tv and go to the recording of this and play it back a few times so this makes a little more sense. The B2RYY, T2RIW on TechNet. Glad you brought this one to us.
Quick question, Dick.
Joe first, and then we're going to go over to John. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, okay. What you... Dick?
I'm hearing you beautifully on the input, Joe. And so you're absolutely right. The 39 and the 10-ohm resistor creates an intentional imbalance, a known amount of imbalance. Now by measuring the standing wave ratio at each of your frequencies, while at each one of those frequencies moving the clip lead to the three different places, it now gives you quantitative data that when you go to Mike's set of equations that he and MPD derive, you now will know the exact amount, so to speak, of imbalance of that balun. How well is that secondary winding of the theoretical transformer, how well is that secondary winding floating? A balun, first of all, it acts like a transformer. The secondary winding has the right number of turns. That means that 50 ohms in is 50 ohms out. You get the right impedance ratio. That's test number one of a balun. Test number two is that secondary winding really floating? If that secondary winding of this transformer, so to speak, if it had a center tap that's grounded, that's not anywhere near as good as a thoroughly floating secondary winding when you want the balancing function where it automatically does current balancing of left side versus right side into the real antenna. And a floating secondary winding of a transformer will do that. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
WGB. Dick, quick question. If I were to look at that ballon with my DNA and place those resistors as Mike suggests, as I short those, I should see very little change in the SWR. That's what you're saying, correct?
Without a doubt, what you said is correct. Now, when it comes to measuring impedance error of the load on the end of a transmission line, there's a lot of instruments will do that for you. A directional power meter, a bird watt meter, properly used, will give you that. A standing wave ratio indicator, a standing wave ratio bridge, a vector network analyzer, an antenna analyzer, an antenna impedance analyzer. Lots of pieces of instrumentation will measure whether or not the signal going down your transmission line does or does not see a pure 50 ohm load. And so any of those could be used for this test if you're smart enough and give you the indication as to what's going on. In the case of a vector network analyzer, not only do you measure what is the magnitude of the standing wave ratio, but properly calibrated, that machine has the ability to give you the phase angle of the reflected power that's creating the standing wave ratio. If you're smart enough, that phase information is giving you one more good piece of information that you can now figure out exactly what's going on. You could, in theory, let me drop it. You could now, in theory, measure exactly, so to speak, how much stray capacitance coupling there is in your transformer action of your ballon. And you might even be able to, with time domain reflectometry techniques, you might even be able to find out how many quarters of an inch downrange inside of the balloning device is the stray capacitive coupling coming from, if you really want to be a scientist. But we're going much too far in this one. So the whole idea of a transmission line that's properly terminated is that the signal goes down there once and never comes back. If any of the signal comes back, that tells you, in the case of a 50-ohm cable, that what's at the end is not a pure 50-ohm resistor. Any number of difference in ohms, any amount of capacitive inductive reactance is going to give you some reflected signal. In the case of a vector network analyzer, that phase angle of what comes back tells you exactly what that load is. Wonder if that makes some more sense, Joe. John, KC2WGB, K2IW.
Yes, Dick. Thank you. Good information. Sounds like an interesting experiment to run. I have a couple of ballons, I think I'll try that out. And my VNAs do TDRs also. So I will do that. Thank you. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And you're getting some real good kudos tonight, Eric, for the quality of that RF link going out to the Eastern machine. Here we go. 147375 machine. KE2EJ, K2IW. Say whatever you want to, Eric.
I'm just thinking about, he's got these calculations, and I'm thinking that, I know what the input voltage is, and as you short each side, if you use a quick-up voltage point, you should be able to figure out on isolation what he's after. So I'm trying to picture it because it is that 50 ohm resistor is sort of a bumped node in which the current flows, and to measure the imbalance on one side to the other. Because if the transformer is truly isolated and you make that connection to ground, it should have no effect.
As I sometimes say, give that man a cigar. Yes. The most severe test is a pure 50 ohm Allen Bradley resistor as a load, and you first do the test and see a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio or something close to it across all your frequencies of interest. And then the most severe test is to take that 50 ohm resistor and with a very short clip lead ground first the left side, then the right side to the grounding of the input coax cable as short as possible with that clip lead. That's the local ground, so to speak. And if putting that clip lead in there makes no change, you're home free. If putting that clip lead there makes some change, then you've got a less than perfect balance. But I'll bet you in a lot of cases it's more than good enough once you start quantifying. I mean, if putting the clip lead on there makes a 1.1 standing wave ratio go to 1.3, that's a damn good balance at that frequency. If putting the clip lead on there makes a 1.1 VISWR go to 6-to-1, you don't have a balance. By that I mean you've got a good impedance match input to output, but you don't have real good isolation of the flow. floating characteristics of that secondary winding of the transformer, so to speak. A real good balance. Acts like a primary winding and a secondary winding that's thoroughly floating of an ideal transformer. That's not what's inside there, but if it's a real good balance, it acts that way. Inside of a black box, you couldn't tell the difference, if you know what I mean. We're going to have to move on, Joe. You've asked a darn good question. We're going to go over to Jim next. KD2BHY, K2LIW and TechNet. You've got it, Jim.
You just had a question about SSTV. Recently, I had tried to decode SSTV from the ISS, and it was really fun, and I really enjoyed it. And I was just wondering, how does SSTV work? How is it encoded, and how is it decoded? Go ahead.
Now, these guys from Fort Washington can ask some really, really good questions. SSTV and the International Space Station, and what's the mode of operation? I haven't the vaguest idea on this one. I hope somebody out there knows about... You got it, Eric. Please answer it.
Okay. Smart Scan TV, SSTV, is a method in which you can send an image using very little bandwidth. And originally, the very first form of SSTV, fax, as you want to call it, is we actually had a drum, and we... time the drum would spin, it would be on line. And there are different formats, 200 lines, 150 lines. And each time that drum would rotate, and actually they would use a conductive paper and put a high voltage to it. And what we would do is we would send a tone, audio-wise, okay, and a low tone would be a black line, and no tone would be a white line. What it would do is would actually change the voltage on the little stylus that was hitting the piece of paper. The more voltage that hit the piece of paper, the blacker the image was on the paper. The lower the voltage, the less you would see a line. And you put that together line by line, and you get an entire image. For the length, I'm going to drop for a second. The length was determined by the size of the drum and the piece of paper that was wrapped around it. How did it know when to start? Well, you actually put the piece of paper in on a line, so it always started on the same physical place on the drum. And the drum itself would make an index pulse so that it would know where it was. And in the transmission, you would send one particular tone, which is called a sync pulse. And that would say, okay, I'm going to start the line now. There would be, at the very beginning of the transmission, a series of pulses that says, I'm going to begin transmission now. That's the very analog way slow scan television started. As we hands got into it, we used a tube which had a long pitch system. So instead of writing it onto a piece of paper, we actually drew the line in the phosphor of a CRT. And because it was a storage device, or a device that had long pitch systems, it would keep that image, keep the light that you drew across that scope to. And that's how we did it for many years. And again, if the transmission method was analog. Okay, let me do the drop again. Now, enter the world of computers. Okay, and we have something like 13 or 14 different standards. This thing called SCSI and this one and that one. And basically, the method of transmission is still analog. But now, enter the idea of doing compression so that we can actually have more detail, the information that we're transmitting. And that's the basic idea behind slow scan TV. K2RW, K2Jack.
Thank you, Eric. Eric, as you probably know, is our local television broadcast engineer who is tightly concerned with, who is tightly coupled to Channel 13, PBS television in New York City, and Channel 21 PBS television out here in Plainview, Long Island. So sending pictures is a fun thing to do. If you try to, as ham radio amateurs have done, send fast scan television, similar to the way it was done in the old days of analog over the broadcast, 6 megacycle bandwidth, 4 megacycles of it was video, and you try to transmit that signal over ham radio frequencies, like on the 435 megacycle band, as guys have done in the past, you discover very rapidly that even if